Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. If you've ever struggled to juggle responsibilities, or if you're like stress is always one step ahead of you, then this conversation will give you practical steps to change how you respond to stress by giving yourself more mental bandwidth. In this episode, you'll understand the connection between your brain's prediction systems and your energy levels and give you the tools to leverage your brain's built-in systems for prevention of burnout. My guest for this episode is Dr. Greg Kelly, with years of experience on strategies to enhance resilience, combining his deep knowledge of neurobiology and nutrition. And so in this episode, you'll discover your brain's energy needs, the role of oxidative stress, predictability, and action planning, and some simple tools to free up mental energy and capacity. So whether you're managing work, relationships, personal growth, this episode will show you how small changes can make a big difference in how you handle everyday stress. Let's get started. Today, we're talking more about the brain and stress. So it's a big topic, I know, but when I think of the brain and its role, especially with trauma and stress, one of the things that really speaks to me is the role of the brain and why the brain can just be in chronic stress. And that's that, you know, we know that the brain didn't really evolve to react to the world in that way. It more is there to try to predict what's going to happen to us next. When we talk about brain and stress, what are some of the highlights that you have discovered in your work, in your research, that led you specifically then to develop a product around resilience and stress?
Sure. I mean, great question. So I love, like, you introducing the idea of prediction. So when I think of the brain's, like, two main concerns, it's predicting the future and protecting itself. And, you know, stress obviously plays a role in both, right? If it can't do a good job of predicting the future, that causes obviously a lot of stress. And then, you know, stress, chronic stress especially, can make it so having the ability and the resources to protect itself are more scarce. And so I wanted to just really start, I guess, how I would explain stress to a patient. And it goes back, and this is in a, I wrote a book called Shapeshift at one point, and one of the chapters on stress. And I introduced what I call it, it was a game in the 60s that my siblings and I had. And it was called the last straw, but it used to also be called the camel game. So just picture, you have this plastic camel, either side's a bucket, and then each person takes a turn. So as two teams would play, would spin a little wheel, whatever color it points to, you would put one of those colored straws in. And, you know, some were heavier than others. And at some point, someone would put that final straw in, the back would collapse, right? So the last straw. And where I think that fits in with stress, but especially in the health context, is we all have baskets. We can all carry so many straws of stress. And at any given point, there's going to be some degree of weight in our basket. And how close we are to that last straw is going to vary. But I tend to think as everything, or pretty much everything, can be a straw. And so the goal is to identify what we can and take it out of the basket before that we, you know, quite literally speaking, have that last straw collapse our brain health or some other aspect of our health. So that's a metaphor I use. And then where the camel comes in is, we want to create resilience. We want to be able to build the capability to carry more straws. It's going to be somewhat of a mystery how full of our basket is. We want to be doing everything we can always to build that resilience. And one of the things that builds resilience for the brain and dealing with stress writ large in the body is having the resources available to have, you know, good adrenal health, good brain function, and all these other jobs that are resource dependent. So that would be my big picture. If people just understood that concept here, I think there's a lot of actionable things looking at our lives and finding out what straws are actually removable. Because the truth is, there's some that aren't, right? There's some, you know, maybe some environmental straws that we can maybe mitigate, but we can't remove them. But there are certain things. And when we talk about the brain, there's a concept called bandwidth. So, you know, we have these basic needs. So, you know, food, sleep, sex drive, thirst, body temperature regulation, that our hypothalamus controls all these, right? So they're needed for survival. And what you would generally see in, you know, anyone that we interact with is if someone has one of those core needs that's not being met, a huge amount of their mental bandwidth is being consumed trying to meet that. So think of someone that's calorie restricting on a diet. And I think Survivor, that TV show, is a good, you know, visual of that, right? These people very quickly aren't getting enough food, so they're hungry, and so their bandwidth is consumed with eating. And we would see the same thing in someone with a lot of willpower to go on a diet. But we'd see the same thing if someone was, you know, like poverty and money was the scarce resource, or so overworked that free time was the scarce resource. Like, whenever your bandwidth is being consumed, that's really stressful. And to the extent possible, we want to be able to then free some of that up. And maybe we can't free it up, you know, if time at this point is the issue. And when that's the case, the goal to reduce stress is first and foremost, those big ones are what's going to break the system. Mm-hmm. So Atelier, who you would know well, the famous grandfather of biological stress, felt after all his years of experiments that mental and emotional stress were by far the biggest straw.
And isn't that interesting? Because we can think of our resilience, we can think of it in terms of our capacity and how much stress we can hold before we give out, our muscles just give in. And there's so much that we can control, and that emotional and mental actually takes up more of our resources right. than something that would be a physical stress.
Correct. And the other thing, what, you know, where the brain comes in is that, like, that idea of rumination. So when, like me personally, if I find myself ruminating, constantly going back and thinking about something, that's consuming bandwidth, right? Like, that could be better served for some other job the brain, you know, maybe wants to do to predict the future better or protect itself. So I know for me, if I find myself constantly going back to something, the goal is to shut that down. And there's invariably some action I can take in the present or the not too distant future that will remove that completely from the table. Mm-hmm. So I think being conscious of what's consuming that bandwidth and freeing up as much as possible. Because what I've seen personally, but also with people I've worked with over the years, is that sometimes even freeing up a little, all of a sudden now something that we couldn't get to, there's more capacity to get to that, and that becomes easier. And it's almost this virtuous cycle, right? So sometimes just starting something really small and getting that off the table, that one little straw can start to build momentum.
And can you speak again on the prediction aspect of this? Because there's so much that I see that even if someone is in an emotionally difficult situation, if they can predict their environment, if they can predict what's going to happen, then they're able to hold that straw longer than if it's something that's unpredictable. How does the brain deal with predictability?
Well, I think the things that are, and a lot in our world is unpredictable. Like, the way I tend to think about it is, like, focus on what we can control. And, like, the other things are going to be a straw, but we can handle some straws. So, like, choose wisely where you'll divert your attention. So, like, if we take, you know, right now, it's been a tough time for stock market as an example, right? And what will happen over the next, you know, week, months is also uncertain, right? I can't know it. People that spend all day trying to figure out can't know it. So there's not a lot we can do. So all you can really do is then, what's a strategy you can put in place to sleep better at night with your investments? But what often happens is the worst. So four things that would be, like, think of, you know, like, you're living, I grew up in New England, right, on a beach. We would get these crazy big winter storms every few years. And since we were right on the beach, my house could flood, right? We never had anything other than our basement flood, but we'd get warning, right? So we'd be able, the warning might not have been long, but we'd have a couple days, like, this may be coming, to stock up on, you know, food, firewood, things that we might need. So that's actually stress reducing. Even when you know something bad's coming, but you can take action in advance to prepare, like, that's the prediction piece. But what's horrible is when you're given, oh, bad news and something's going to come and there's not enough time to prepare, right? Because then the prediction can't come in. So that's actually more stressful. And then what often then happens is, after the fact, people are well-intentioned, but then say, well, you should have done this. That's even worse, right? Because now there's nothing.
Add shame to that.
Right. And so, like, the time to give people advice is when it's actionable. After the fact, you want to give them comfort and reassurance. Like, give them a big hug, don't tell them what they should have done differently. So that's like when you can predict is when is the good time to try to help people. And after the fact, that's when you should comfort and reassure. But tended befriend behaviors is what we'd call them.
And I love that you're talking about being able to plan ahead and take action, because that is how we hold more stress without it crushing us. And so it's something that many people who have been listening to the talks in the summit have heard me say that over and over again, right? It's when we are not able to take action that something actually overwhelms the system. As long as we can take action, come up with a plan, then we're able to hold more of that stress longer. Yep. And so love that you're talking about that. And yeah, when we talk about taking action, like we do need internal resources for that. Right? So it comes back to that conversation around, well, what's your bandwidth? What's your internal resources like? And how can we build that? Because that is going to be a source of resilience for people as well.
And then the one thing, and this comes out in research all the time, is one of the most limiting resources in the brain, frankly, is energy. The brain is by far the most voracious consumer of biological energy in our whole body. You know, I think usually you see an estimate it uses about 20% of all our fuel for the day. So when we want our brain to do more, you know, say recover from stress or deal with stress or remove straws, sometimes that means we need more energy than we currently have been using. Like one of the things I think is really cool about brain and energy is, like, I don't know how to play the piano, but if I said, oh, I want to learn how to play the piano like as good as this person, that person's brain, they're so good at playing the piano, it takes almost no energy. Mine would take a crazy amount to even play it badly, right? So we often compare ourselves to others, but one of that 10,000 hour rule, right? That idea of becoming a master of something, part of the why our brain does that is because it kind of burns it into memory and it makes it really efficient to do it. So one of the things I would always coach people is, you know, when you're trying to master something new or change a habit, those are times when you need more energy. Like what was good enough to just live your normal life is probably not quite enough to make these big changes. And so that's where, like, I would use the idea of resources. If we're asking our brain to do more, let's make sure we're giving it more resources, both nutritionally, you know, getting maybe more sleep, you know, things like that, that are on their own straws. Like, I guess you can think of sleep as either a straw or something that builds resilience, but it's something that will cause, you know, a collapse if we're neglecting it. So,
yeah. And I mean, you're speaking my language, because out of all of the biology of trauma modules that I run in the certification course for practitioners, one module is just on energy. Because from my viewpoint, trauma is an energy problem.
Yep.
If we had more energy, we would be able to stay longer holding that stress capacity. Yep. And it's when we don't have that energy, we haven't given more energy to our brain. And it's like, hey, I'd love to do more for you, but I can't. You're not giving me the energy. So we're going to need to kind of shut down and we're going to just, you know, hunker down and get through the storm that way.
Super important. I'm so glad you mentioned how important that is to the courses and the modules you teach. Because I think fundamentally, you know, when I think of brain, the energy is the thing I always come back to.
Yes. Yes. So speaking of brain, you've done the research and developed a product just for building resilience in the brain around stress.
Yeah. So it's called Qualia Resilience. We could think of it as a neuroadaptogen. So we have adaptogens in it. There's four actually, but a centerpiece is ashwagandha. So ashwagandha it's a nootropic. It's widely used as a brain supporting nutrient. Ayurveda is where it's famous. As they would call it a rasayana, so a rejuvenator, but we would think of that in modern terms as an adaptogen. And a good way, I think, to think of adaptogens are things that can help that resilience. So the way I tend to think of an adaptogen, it's like a little dose of stress that makes our capability to handle stress, like our stress muscle, fitter, right? So like we don't want to overdo adaptogens. I generally dose them 5 days on, 2 days off, because I think of them more like exercise. Let's give a challenge. Let's give you a little time to recover. So that product Quality Resilience, that would be our recommended dose. You'll see, you know, recommend take 5 days a week. So adaptogens and ashwagandha specifically, like that's a calming adaptogen, something very well known for stress. But what you would see if you went into the nootropic subreddit and, you know, put ashwagandha in, there's a subset of people that ashwagandha works almost too well for. It's too calming and it saps their motivation. So you'll even see sometimes people describe it, oh, it's like kryptonite for my motivation. So we are using a newer ashwagandha called nuganda, like the idea of nootropic ashwagandha, that tried to leave in the stress compounds, but remove some of them that are almost too calming or too sedating. Mm-hmm. So that's
how interesting. So in your research, are you finding that ashwagandha for some people and those people that find that their motivation goes down, is it affecting their dopamine levels? Because when I think of motivation, like I think of dopamine, right? Like that is your for motivation sure. neurotransmitter. Is there science on that? Is that what's happening?
I haven't seen that explored, but it's ashwagandha definitely has some compounds in it that influence the GABA pathway. So, okay. You know, it could be that, you know, often nootropics, people will take ashwagandha in the evening instead of the morning. So some could be timing. I think a lot would be dopamine system over time, personally. But anyways, that's why we went with that specific ashwagandha, because nuganda has been studied in a couple different studies now for a cognitive element, executive function primarily. Mm-hmm. And then
is its main mechanism of action GABA then, or is it having a different mechanism of action for improving that cognition aspect?
It would be different. Like it reduces cortisol at that. And even in that study, so the 30-day study on it was interesting. They did a 225 and a 400 milligram dose versus placebo and compared them. And the 225 worked much better. It was the most efficient for reducing cortisol, had the best executive function response, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing to think of with adaptogens. They don't really follow or more is better. They're more like that Goldilocks principle, right? Like the just right amount. So
yeah, it's like the healthy stress that we want to do with our physical activity.
Yep, exactly.
Don't overdo it, because that's not healthy. You're going to overwhelm your system. And yet that's actually, we need a degree of positive stress in order correct. For there to be growth. Dr. Greg, is there cortisol in the brain itself, or is this nuganda acting just on the blood cortisol, the peripheral cortisol?
Yeah, they would measure the blood cortisol. So anything it would be doing in the brain, we couldn't do those in human studies. So, but in general, it's like almost as above, so below, like those track closely together. And then we have a couple other adaptogens in it, holy basil, which plays very well with that, and then Eleutherococcus, which used to be called Siberian ginseng, which again, in Soviet scientists studied, long story short, is panax ginseng, like, you know, true ginseng, was in their supply. So in their search to try to find a replacement, they eventually settled on Eleutherococcus, which is in the same family, but it's not a panax species. And it was called Siberian ginseng because they found it had basically, in many cases, for what would be thought of, or what I would describe as mental and physical stamina, Eleutherococcus was superior. So it's a very underused adaptogen. Mm-hmm. And they studied it from somewhere around 1950 to 1984 and, you know, had written more than 1,000 scientific articles on it over those decades. So it never quite got the research in PubMed that, you know, that you would see compared to an ashwagandha as an example, but a really mm-hmm. solid adaptogen. Mm-hmm. So those cover the adaptogen basis, but then one of the ingredients in it, I don't think your audience would know about, but it's actually a cantaloupe extract. It's called Extramel. And it goes back to like 1989 mm-hmm. in a French market, some of the people were noticing that this one new variety of cantaloupe had a crazy long shelf life compared to regular cantaloupe. So they eventually tried to figure out why, and it was because it had high amounts of superoxide dismutase, so SOD, an antioxidant enzyme, and then also high amounts of, you know, catalase and glutathione peroxidase, some other antioxidant enzymes. And over time, that led to this standardized extract that's standardized to deliver SOD. And the studies on it are really interesting because they've given it, you know, in human studies, as an example, one of them was for 84 days long, I believe. But, you know, they measured perceived stress scale, you know, cognitive function, a whole bunch of things that directly interface with that brain stress. And it rocked. I mean, it was one of the better results I've ever seen in any natural substance study. So, you know, so anyways, Extramel is another centerpiece ingredient. And then in terms of resources, so B vitamins, both for that energy piece, but especially B1 and B5 have lots of old research from the early days of vitamin research. So the 40s and 50s for adrenals, especially, you know, so think of B vitamins as critical for building both the neurotransmitters, but any B vitamin deficiency usually will weaken the adrenals, but those two especially are really, really important for adrenal health.
Yeah, and I feel that they really have not gotten the exposure that they deserve, right? And in all of my work, even specifically with addiction medicine, and all of the research that we have, Dr. Greg, on that thiamine in the addiction recovery process and how many of them are so depleted and how it really helps with that emotional component, a lot of the depression will be aided with that. So yeah, so this is really important stuff. And even there are quite a few studies looking at PTSD and how it can be a trigger, it can be an epigenetic trigger from the oxidative stress inside the cells. And so being able to have tools to keep that oxidative stress down is going to push away that potential trigger to cross a line that we don't want to cross in terms of our mental and emotional health.
The way I would frame it is it's probably safe to say most external stress eventually converts into oxidative stress at the level Absolutely. Of our cells and mitochondria. And then SOD is super interesting. Like SOD is, like, if you look in PubMed and put like plant SOD stress, you'll get these articles that it's one of the most foundational resilience molecules that plants use. And that's conserved through the animal kingdom as well. And then one last thing just to mention is it's called the polyamine stress response, but this is also conserved in animals and plants and is really important in both our brain and our adrenals. But when there's stress, our brain tries to make more of these compounds called polyamines. They have names like, you know, putrescine and spermidine, and not pleasant sounding names, but that's again a conserved stress response. It's crazy important for resilience. And so one of the things we put in our resilience product that I don't think you'll see widely used for stress is ornithine, because ornithine is the key thing that the brain tries to turn more of into polyamines when it's under stress. So that's a lot to download.
Yeah, no, I don't see ornithine in a lot of the other resilience or stress types of products. And that's been again, a thing that I consider has not gotten the exposure that it has needed in this stress and trauma response. Well, Dr. Greg, thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your expertise. And honestly, like, thank you for the work that you put in to improving people's lives. And in this case, really directly being able to help increase their capacity for stress. And my goodness, we need that these days.
For sure. And thank you and your audience for having me. This has been a pleasure. It's been lovely to talk with you.
And thank you for tuning into this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. This is a big topic, and I have resources for you in the show notes. I will have a free guide on the essential sequence. This is the sequence of the body's trauma response and what that means for coming out. So when the body has been storing trauma, there is a sequence, and it goes through stress just like it goes through stress to get into the trauma response. I also have some related podcast episodes on this topic of stress. One would be episode 83 with Emma McAdam on the science of anxiety. Also episode 99 on trauma-informed medicine and why dysregulation should be included in assessments with my friend, Dr. Jarena Albers. On YouTube, I have a video on what does the stress response look like in the body, and another video on the difference between stress and trauma. You'll want to check those out. And if you are noticing that your body has been under chronic stress, you will want to consider starting to take magnesium. Not just any magnesium, but chelated magnesium and multiple forms of that chelated magnesium. I will have a link in the show notes for the magnesium that I use for these multiple forms of chelated so that you know what to get. I am here to save you time and money by bringing you practical information that will help you accelerate the healing journey. So please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review. Your feedback is how I know how to improve this podcast, bring you great content, and help you find information that will change your life. I'm your host, Dr. Amy, and until next episode, lots of love.